Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Open Mic Comedy Podcast. I'm your host, Mark. If this is your first time here, welcome. If you're a returning listener, welcome back. This podcast is here for those on the open mic comedy circuit, whether you're a comedian, an MC, a promoter, a tutor, or anyone who has any involvement in this industry. Even comedy fans who really want to spend their time in pub basements watching the possible stars of the future. If you're thinking about getting into the open mic comedy circuit and you want to know what to expect, this is most definitely for you. Today's guest is someone I started my comedy journey with, a man who I've seen go from being a nervous pacing wreck before transforming into a confident performer the moment his foot hits the stage. His comedy journey has involved taking part in gong shows and also pitting his wits in a roast battle. So please welcome to the stage, Jacob Newstead. Hey man, how you doing?
Yeah, not bad. Thanks for having me. I think that's the first time I've ever gotten applause with anything comedy related. So it's good. It's a nice start. It's a beautiful intro. Thank you very much.
It's okay.
Yeah, no, it's good to. It's been a while, so it's good to see you.
And you. So what's the what's happened in this start of the year then for you?
At the start of the year, I did a few gigs, bringer gigs, 5-minute spots, and then I went on to do a gong event. I was trying to book, and it's just like balancing kind of work life and then doing this while trying to do comedy and trying to make people laugh, I suppose. Yeah. And writing as well, trying to write as much as possible. I don't know how you find it with writing, but sometimes you have an idea and sometimes it's like late at night or whatnot, and then you'll write it down, and then in the morning you look over it and it seems rubbish. And then sometimes you just try and sit there and you're just like, right, I've got an hour spare. I'll try and write something, and then nothing comes to you, and then you might get like 4 or 5 ideas at once. Still early on in doing this comedy adventure.
Yeah, so as I would say. We started this together at the beginning of 2023, January, from memory.
Was it January?
Yeah, it was the first part, I think, we started. So for people that don't know, we both did the same course. With a comedian you would have heard on this podcast, Ben Clover, based in London. So I guess the first question is, why did you decide to do that?
Well, two answers to that. I mean, like everybody that you'd meet on here, that you'll meet in the circuit. I mean, a lot of people think they're funny or they're told they're funny at school, right?
Yeah.
And then you never really kind of know. So it's good to try something.
Yep.
Like this, and it makes you feel uncomfortable as well.
Yes.
But it was quite random. So I went out with my wife, and she was working the next day, and we've got kids and stuff, so we barely go out and do anything together. So we went out, and we went to a pub, and there was like a quiz night, and my wife didn't really want to be there because we were having a few drinks, and then it was just going to, she knows how it'll kind of turn out, and she had to go to work in the morning. So we decided on Avatar 2. Went to Avatar 2, went to get the tickets, but after having about 3 or 4 drinks, I didn't want to sit down and watch Avatar, which is, a 7-hour film and whatnot. I've not seen the first one either, so I thought, we can't do this. So it was around Leicester Square.
Yeah.
And then we looked on our phone, what can we do? And then there was a night, it was a gong show, ironically enough, at the comedy store.
Mm-hmm.
So we went there and was like, okay, it's in the middle, won't be too much drinking. And we won't watch something boring for 7 hours. So we went there. And I remember some of the people that came up. There was one person, and I think he started off by saying, if you look at my teeth and my accent, it's obvious I'm from Essex.
Right.
Instantly gonged off.
Yeah.
And I was just like, okay, is this like the level? I think maybe I could do this or last 10 seconds longer than this fella.
Yeah.
So I had a fantastic night and I just loved it. I loved like the whole atmosphere of people heckling, comedians on stage, looking a little bit flustered, some of them absolutely killing it. So it's one of those things, you just wanted to try it. So I looked online, see what you can do in London. And then, that course came up, signed up to it. I think it was great. I don't know how many weeks we did. It was like 8 weeks.
Something like that.
And then from there, started doing it, fell in love with it. And I think there's a few of us still doing it now or trying to do it. And that's basically it. I mean, it culminated in what, like a showcase where people came over. It was like five minutes long. And then after that, I kind of got the bug, which a lot of people that you speak to on this podcast have.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. And it's quite addictive. Yep. Like going out on stage or writing something that you think's funny and then finding out it just isn't. And just people don't laugh. And sometimes it can go the other way. You should be like, oh, this is absolute nonsense. Yeah. Should I try it? Should I not? And then you try it and sometimes it goes over quite well. But yeah, sound cliche, long story short, but that's basically it. I went to that night, first time I saw a gong show, loved it. And then, you know, wanted to try and get into it any which way. And I'd recommend anyone listening to this, if they can find some kind of course like that. It's not too much money. It's a laugh. You meet people. I mean, that's how we met. We've been friends for like, since it started, like a year.
I think the course is a very good, it's a good eye opener into what you can do. I think I think without the course, there's no way on earth I would have ever done any kind of comedy because I just wouldn't know how to. I wouldn't know what to do. You can write a joke, but you know the theory behind telling a joke, but when it comes to actually doing it, and you start mumbling your words and you start messing up a punchline and stuff like this, and it becomes a bit woolly and demoralizing when it doesn't work. So a bit of guidance and a bit of help and some structure, I think, is especially that the course gives you, any course probably gives you, is something that means people will take it further.
Yeah, and I think also it's not like some people like turn their nose up at like a course, for example. It's just like a course to be funny, but that's not essentially kind of what it is. No. It's like learning how to put like jokes across and like you said, like the theory, like how to write them properly, and just like being with other people and putting ideas out there. Because like I could understand if people are just like, what do you mean you're doing a course and you can't be taught like how to be funny? But essentially, if you kind of are funny or you think you are, you'll find out.
Yeah.
Kind of funny. But like I say, it just helps you formulate and put the ideas down in a way which might make a few people laugh. And I mean, it's just good anyway. If you don't want to continue doing it and you don't want to spend, you know, however long afterwards doing it, and you just want it's, I mean, it's a good thing to do. It's like people do stuff with like white collar boxing. They'll do it for like 10 to 12 weeks and whatnot. Yeah. And then at the end, have like an amateur thing. And it's essentially that. You'll invite your family and friends and whatnot, and they'll come and watch. And then,
I think the confidence it can give you is something you can use in life, not just in comedy.
Yeah,
having the ability to go up on stage, and even if you're kind of used to doing it in a work environment, which is kind of how I started, is that you're not trying to appease people in a work environment. But if you know you can tell a couple of jokes, and if you can get a few laughs in that 5 minutes. You succeeded. You've made that connection with a group of people that want to be entertained and don't just want to listen how to fill in an Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah, exactly. And I think as well, it's good to be aware if you do one of these courses, usually at the end of it, people are going to laugh, right? Because it's like your family and friends, and they'll be like quite supportive, even if what you say isn't necessarily that funny. But then when you start going out into the wild, you go to like random gigs, it's dramatically different. Because people don't know you and stuff like that. So you could slay in front of your family, but give you quite a nice supportive laugh. And then you'll go out to some random pub in Stockwell in front of like four people and a dog.
Yeah.
And you'll start saying, who's this bald idiot?
Yeah.
And that lot, and you'll feel a little bit disheartened. So I think it's good to be aware that they're dramatically different once you do that, because I was off a high from the course at the end of it. And then as soon as I did my next show, it was just, straight back down. But you've just got to keep going.
But I do think sometimes though that even though in the second gig or whatever, even if you don't get the full on laughs that you was hoping for that you got in your showcase, just getting a couple more, just to get a couple along the way, it enforces something in your brain that says I can do something.
Yeah,
you know where it goes after that, it doesn't matter. But I do think there has to be that kind of attitude where you just go out and do it and find out if you can do it.
Yeah, exactly.
I think the course is such a great stepping stone from whoever runs whichever course, not just necessarily one we did, but there's loads of them out there now, and just give you that confidence to work out what you want to do and how you want to do it, and you go on the journey with other people as well.
Yeah,
and I think that's partly that's one of the most fun parts of it. You see how people develop.
Yeah.
And then, you see how they get on and stuff like that. And I think it's a good bit of fun.
Yeah, so, like even seeing your act and stuff. I mean, it's just like over time, it's just because I won't see you for like a few gigs and then you'll do this, that and the other and we stay in contact via WhatsApp. And then we bump into each other. It's good to see like how jokes like evolve and some of them you just drop and yeah. So it's good.
So leading on from the course, so you've walked away from the course. You're on a high. You want to do some proper gigs now. I say proper gigs. So what's been the best and the worst moments you've experienced on a stage since then?
I've not had a worst moment yet. I've like killed every time I've
come on, Mr. Modest. Well,
worst one. I was in Japan and I went over there for work.
Yeah.
A friend that I know out there, I lived out there, we met up and he said, "Look, there's a comedy now." And I'm interested in comedy and whatnot. I've only done like three gigs before that. I went there, I was in Tokyo. And then all of a sudden I got called up. And he signed me up without me knowing.
Right.
And I didn't know whether to do like bits in Japanese or bits in English. I mean, you can't really judge like looking at a crowd if they speak English or not, because you don't know these days. I mean, you can't judge based on what someone looks like.
Yeah.
I went up absolutely bombed. I used like jokes that I used when I was like a high school teacher loads of like years ago, which were just silly. Like primary school jokes, nobody yeah. really laughed and nobody really cared. And it was like the longest 5 minutes of my life. That was like one of the worst times. The jokes was just like a five-year-old would be telling them, just trying to play on words and whatnot and experiences about Japan and stuff that wasn't even relevant in the news for like 10 years. So there's like people at 18-year-olds in the crowd that wouldn't have got any of it because I was in Japan 10 years ago from that time. So that was the worst. I've had plenty of them. Yeah, some of them in London as well, like in Stockwell. Went up, no one kind of laughed.
Yeah.
And it's just hard to bring people back when no one kind of laughs. And then you start mumbling your words. I think I told one joke, forgot the punchline, which is maybe the most important point. And then afterwards, feeling down, just wanted to sit on my own, just have a beer. And then somebody came up and was like, you know, it was awful. And I was like, oh, thank you very much. That's... No, it makes me feel absolutely fantastic. So it ruined it like even more. Best time was, it's just like when family come over, like from Scunthorpe originally. So my mum came over, a few people have come up to see me, and then jokes kind of go over. And it's hard to get that balance between like jokes that are referencing like Scunthorpe and areas my family would know about, but then no one else in the crowd does. When you've slain, which I've done very few times, but it's just trying to get there again is just the reason you do it, has been like the biggest high. And then you get clips and then you can watch a clip back, and if a clip just absolutely slays, then you've kind of got that essentially forever, and then you can upload it and whatnot, and then you get instant feedback from other people. And highs are always when you get compliments of like other comedians. Especially people that have been doing it a long time will say, oh, that was a good bit. Oh, we kind of got that. I think just killing is the best part. And the worst part is being signed up when you wasn't meant to be. Just falling apart simply on stage. I mean, only 5 minutes. Like, I don't know, some of these comedians do like an hour and a half. And then you're just there 5 minutes in and it's just you want to burst into tears. What am I doing?
Yeah, the 5 minutes of no laughter is a long, long 5 minutes.
Oh yeah,
of laughter is just—it's over too quickly. But the those pauses you put in and the waiting around, and you kind of go—that's the bit you should have laughed at. That's the bit.
I mean, I'm married, so most of my jokes never go over at home. I mean, I never get any laughs at home, but it's a lot worse when it's in front of like, I don't know, 30, 40, 50 people. It hurts a little bit more.
So actually there's one thing I wanted to touch on was that I when we finished the course together, I went off and then started doing some gigs and stuff. You did a few, and then you went and did a further course as well.
Yeah.
So how was that kind of different in terms of because I guess they class it as the improvers course, don't they? It's like the next stage on.
Yeah, they say improvers, but essentially it's just taking your money for essentially the same essentially the same thing. No, it is. It says improvers course, but it's I mean, you do similar things, but it's just 10 minutes, like longer than the other showcase. But
yeah.
I just thought it was quite good to write in those kind of groups, do some of those exercises. Mm-hmm. And like I said, it wasn't kind of much money. Good way to spend evenings, like outside of the pub, for example.
Yeah.
Work a little bit more, learn a bit more about gigs. Like Ben was the person that took the course, right? And
yeah.
I thought he was fantastic. So yeah, why not do it again? But yeah, it was 10 minutes as opposed to 5. So that was the only difference. Essentially, the things we did, the exercises we did were the same, but it's just like a bit more improv. And I think improv's like the hardest thing to do.
Yeah.
It's just you get like 3 topics, and then you have to get up and do like a minute on it. You get to prepare for like 5 minutes. And I think that's the hardest thing, especially in front of people, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you're outside, or if you're sat in a pub, maybe it's a lot easier. But then if you get up sober in front of like 10 other people, and it's just like, okay, you have to talk about cards.
Yeah.
So, and then it's just for a minute, and I don't know kind of what to do. But I suppose the more you do them exercises, the easier it kind of gets.
Yeah.
And I think they're always important because I'm always worried about getting heckled, because you don't know what somebody's going to heckle, and then you don't know how you're going to reply, if it's going to work. And obviously, you don't want to get like a heckler to get the better side of you. Do you know what I mean? If you're meant to be the comedian, so to speak.
Yeah.
So them exercises are always quite good. But essentially, to answer your question, it's just 10 minutes instead of 5. Exactly the same. Exactly the same.
But it's still
so
that.
You didn't miss much.
It's fun. It's still fun, though.
Yeah, it was. It was all right. Smaller groups, though, because it was 10 minutes. So I think with ours, there was 10 or 12 people. But in these courses, it's always interesting to see people because they always kind of fall out, right?
Yeah.
It gets kind of harder and harder, and then...
Yeah, I think our one started with it's somewhere between 16 and 18 people.
Yeah.
And then by the time we got to the showcase, it was 11 or 12.
Yeah. I think what's fantastic about these as well is like if you go and you spend money to see somebody, right, you essentially know what kind of comedy they're going to do.
Yeah.
But when you're in these courses, it's like 10 or 15 people that just could have completely different senses of humor.
Oh,
like
yeah.
So somebody could be like super dark, and like their interesting comedy is just, I don't know, stuff that you wouldn't essentially kind of joke about. I did bits about like Epstein and Rolf Harris and whatnot, and then you'll get somebody else that's just like acting like a dog on stage or something like that. I mean, it's just completely different.
But I think it's interesting that there's a wide variety of ages as well. People that go up and do it.
Yeah,
because I don't think I was quite the oldest person, but I was definitely in the top 25% of the older people in our class. And I remember there was one thing we were doing. It was one of the very, I think it might have been the first day they put us in groups of 4 or 5. And you had to kind of do some kind of exercise. And I just heard from behind me in the group behind some kid who, he was 18, 19 years old, something like that. And there was a lady in the group called Katie, who I think was probably a fair bit younger than me, but still on the older side. And she was trying to explain to him what a teletext holiday was.
Yeah.
He had no idea. And it's quite interesting when you realize that how quickly the world we live in revolves.
Yeah.
To how you go from booking a teletext holiday to now booking a holiday online, and how they are actually very similar things.
Yeah.
But they're still two dramatically different things, but they're still, the premise is still the same. But just hearing somebody say, I have no idea what you're talking about. And it's like, this that wasn't that long ago.
I mean, I get that all the time. I have no idea what you're talking about, even if it's something that's in the news currently. But I remember teletext. There's not a day that goes by, Mike, where I don't think about teletext.
CFAX.
Well, I don't know. CFAX might have been a little bit. We might be showing like the generational gap. But I remember it was Bamboozle.
Yes.
Remember Bamboozle?
Yeah.
It was like a quiz. And you had the buttons. You had like the red, the green, the blue.
Yellow.
Yellow, essentially.
Yeah.
So I used to play that every morning, and it had that little guy, that teletext guy on it. He was a chunky guy.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know if he was the old, top 25%. I know I was definitely the baldest. I was definitely the baldest. I remember I started doing bald. There was me and another guy that was bald. I remember he came up to me and he said, after the first day, he was like, I'm thinking about doing bald jokes as well. And I was just like, well, yeah, plenty of people do. I mean, it's not revolutionary in the slightest. Yeah. But it's just like on the showcase, if it was put together, then it would have been a bit awkward, right? It's just like a couple of bald people just banging on about being bald. But it was funny as well, like, just if it's the same topic, just two different people, like how they would approach the topic differently.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, it was interesting having like such a diverse group of people doing it.
So you've I've mentioned in the introduction you've got into the roast battle scene probably quicker than most open mic comics would have done in terms of the number of gigs you've done and the amount of time you've been on there before you've put yourself forward for it.
Yeah.
So for those that aren't aware, that maybe not be so much in London or whatever, the roast battle is an idea of two comedians basically going up on stage and ripping the shit out of each other constantly for 5-10 minutes, whatever it is. But how does everything work in, like, take us through the moment you decided I'm going to do this to what happened before you then got on stage and the aftermath?
Yeah, I think a roast battle, you should, how quickly, I mean, there's some people that just exclusively do roast battles instead of like writing jokes where it's kind of one way you're saying to the audience X, Y, and Z. People are just roast battling, but I'll explain essentially what it is. So a roast battle is basically two comedians, as you said, and then maybe a week beforehand you exchange like 10 facts about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't be like, oh, I like blue, you know, like you know, I'm from Scunthorpe or whatever. It's, they have to be quite deep, like anxiety, for example. So I put an anxious person, I've had issues with OCD in the past. So they're quite personal, and then you get them off the other person, and then they're quite personal. And then you write jokes essentially about it. So you write 3 jokes. I mean, you do one joke, then they'll do a joke. And after you do or they do a joke, you've got a chance to rebuttal. But yeah, I did it quite early on. And it was, I went to one and watched it and I thought this was quite good. And in a drunken haze, I signed up and I thought, oh, you know, this looks like absolutely fantastic. And then I got an email like the next day saying, okay, you're on this date. And then you find out like who you're battling. And it was, Luke Hall, a good comedian. And he does quite a lot. I mean, he's known for it kind of thing. So I was like, okay, fine. And then, yeah, you essentially go up, do a joke, go, and then back and forth. And then it's in front of 3 comedians.
Okay.
I've been doing it like a long time. And then at the end of votes, like, I think won. And then, yeah, I think I lost like 2-1, but it was completely one sided. Didn't expect it. Like, getting up, you get nervous anyway.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
The whole crowd was completely different. It was like a bear pit. Like, as soon as you went, I was just getting roasted by the crowd and everything like that. And then I was like kind of nervous, just didn't hold the mic close enough. And then I remember I met him before. He's a nice guy.
Yeah.
And then he was just like, it's your first roast battle. And that'll be okay. Do you want to go first on me? I was like, this seems like a brilliant guy. And then we went up and I made a joke, something daft about his height, about his personality. What is it? Something like, sometimes he's sleepy, sometimes he's bashful, sometimes he's dopey, but most of the time he's depressed because he tried to commit suicide about a year ago. So something silly like that. It was quite lighthearted. And all of a sudden he started going on about my mum having an abortion, going down on my mum. I was like, where has this come from? And I was absolutely flummoxed.
Yeah.
So that was it. And then it all kind of went a little bit downhill, but the experience was fantastic. And it wasn't as much as like getting roasted by him.
Yeah.
It was like the people judging. It wasn't they just judging. It was like, oh, he won. Then they started hammering me as well. And I was like, this is like one of the worst nights kind of ever had. And I put myself forward for it kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I remember going to my wife like afterwards. She was just like, oh, how did it go? It wasn't the best thing in the world.
Yeah.
So I told her the jokes before. And she was just like, some of them are a little bit harsh. You can't talk about someone's wife and stuff like that. And I was like, okay, let's keep it a little bit, maybe vanilla. Let's not kind of go straight for the throat. And I thought it's the best thing to do, as I met him before. He was just, really polite. And then he started going on about going down on my mum and stuff. I was like, Jesus Christ. It's like, mum's a prostitute and that. Like, I was like, fucking hell. And then it was just over like that.
Yeah.
And then I spoke to other people there and it's like, we couldn't really hear you. The mic wasn't close enough. And but yeah, definitely do it again. It was certainly an experience. After the therapy for 6 months afterwards, not being able to sleep, crying myself to sleep, and I'm like, nah, it's fine. It's all good fun.
Yeah.
And I think, it's a good experience to kind of get roasted and feel uncomfortable on stage. It kind of doesn't make you feel good at the time, but then I think the more you do, it's sort of like water off a duck's back, essentially. Yeah. I'd do another. But it was funny because the night that I did, it was like every week, every Friday.
Yeah.
And then as soon as I did my roast battle, it was like once every month.
Oh.
So in my head, I thought, was I that bad? Like, I've absolutely ruined an event where now it's essentially once a month instead of like four times a month. But no, it wasn't because of that at all. But I think you should definitely do one. It's trial by fire.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't recommend anyone that wants to get into it to do it after five games or something. But I'd go watch them. If anybody like sees a night where it's like a roast battle, they're really, really good. They're really good. Just such a different vibe, such a different atmosphere. Like I say, like everybody's kind of drunk. People heckle and shout. And they are good.
Yeah, I don't know. Sometimes I find the... I've been to a few gigs where you've got like half the audience are cut. So I've gone to like a late night show at Top Secret at midnight or whatever. And you just look at the comedians and go, gee, I hope you're getting paid well for this.
Yeah.
Because you're not getting a set out of this. And there's you've probably got like half the audience who want to hear the jokes. And you've got the other half of the audience that just want to chat between themselves or shout stuff at people. And you're just like, come on. People are paid money for this. Fuck up and let people talk.
Exactly. And I think the more experience that we get, it's just it'll be easier for us to call people out, right? Because you'll have like so much experience. Like, because I notice when people heckle, people ask essentially, what do you do for work and whatnot? And then they'll normally go down that avenue or like, is the person you're with like your partner and whatnot?
Yeah.
And it all depends on like where you are on in the night. Like, sometimes if you're on last, like people are and they're just like, I can't be asked anymore, especially if there's like a lot of comics on one after the other. Like, there could be some nights where there's like 8 to 10 comics on, and then some people are just like, I just want to go home, man. Like, it's just, and then they'll just start being rude, or they'll start just messing about, or they'll just leave.
I think we're quite lucky in the sense of the open mic circuit. There's not too much of that in terms of heckling that goes on. Most of the heckling on the open mic circuit is pretty much frowned upon. You can chuck it at the MC, they'll take it and they'll throw it back at you and they'll insult you to the cows come home if that's what you want to do. But yeah, I think especially when you're in your practice arena, shall we call it, you have a fairly safe space in terms of not being heckled, unless you bring it on yourself by just going out and insulting somebody from the start, which is probably never the best thing to do. But the roast battle is, it's such a unique way of doing it, I think. Of you see some of the stuff that goes on television, you can imagine the stuff that goes on in the clubs like Angel, etc. When they put it on, it's another level of darkness.
Oh yeah, I mean that kind of stuff wouldn't get aired.
Yeah,
I mean you get everyone's nan ringing like Ofcom and stuff like that. This was absolutely unbelievably offensive. It's not Ant and Dec at all.
No,
it's like pretty bad, like going on about abortions and stuff like that, and it's just it is what it is. But I mean, it's all fun. It depends what kind of comedy you want, right? I mean, it's certainly something you can experience. It's what's kind of not for the lighthearted.
No, definitely. So you've we also took part together. I say together. We were on the same bill on a Gong show recently up the creek. So how did you find, you're one of the only ones that I can really ask about this, how do you find the Gong versus roast? Now you've done both, because I saw you before the Gong Show, and yeah. I've never seen somebody walk up and down a little aisle so many times going, fucking, am I ready for this? And then you were brilliant on the night. You should have got through.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I think it was just like, I think it was 10 or 13 seconds left. Yeah. I think I was going on about too many nonces and people had enough. I mean, I went from like Jeffrey Epstein with Michael Jackson thrown in there. David Copperfield, and then went straight to Rolf Harris and stuff. But thank you. It was good. I think it's different in the sense that I thought the Gong Show was like a little bit harder. But I think with the Gong Show, because you know, like you mentioned on your pod before, I'm sure people that are listening to you know what a Gong Show is. But essentially, it's just random three people in the audience have a card. You get 2 minutes of grace period in this. But in other ones, you don't get any at all.
Yeah.
And then once a card goes up, one light goes on, essentially, and then all three cards go up, then you kind of get gonged off. But I think with the Gong Show, it's because people can control how long you're going to be up there. I think more importantly, it depends what position in the lineup you kind of are.
Yeah.
Like if you're last, again, people might not want to be there. They would just want to go home. Let's just go. And essentially, if one or two people, or those three people, don't like your act, then other people do. It's like they could just have you off anyway.
Yeah.
I don't think it's an accurate description as well if like people are that funny or doing that well, because sometimes you'll get three people that are super harsh,
mm-hmm.
and then they'll change the cards, and then other people will just be like a little bit more chilled out. Okay, we'll let this run a little bit longer, kind of thing. So in terms of Gong, I think positioning's is so important. Like first as well, people don't know how harsh to be, because you could get comedians that are really good. Like the one we did, like the first half, people were just getting gonged off and they were fantastic.
Yeah.
Like there was people, I remember when you got gonged off, you was right at the end of a punchline and people were coming up after and saying that we wanted to hear the rest of that.
Yeah.
Can't believe it. It was like nonsense. And then even the MC was just like halfway through, was just like, come on guys, chill out.
Yeah.
I mean, we just like the show's got to be longer than about 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Everybody's kind of not done anything. And then obviously you get anxiety, and then there's people in the back, like the comedians, and they're just like, what is going on here?
Yeah.
I saw that guy like two nights ago, absolutely kill. Absolutely. He won a Gong night, for example. And then 2 minutes, he was just off.
Yeah.
And it's like, what's going on? And because they're moaning about it, it gives me even more anxiety. So I'm pacing up and down even quicker. but as opposed to the roast, you know what you're getting with a roast? Well, I do now.
Yep.
You know, you're not going to essentially get gonged off, but the crowd are going to shout stuff at you, like roast battles and stuff, or like you're rubbish or whatnot, and that kind of thing. Both can be brutal.
Mm-hmm.
If you do them too early, they can like knock your confidence. I've known people that were good and funny, who were starting out just like us, and then they've done one gong night, and that's it. They're just like, I can't do this. It was just absolutely brutal.
Yeah.
But the one we did was good because you had at least 2 minutes.
Yeah.
I remember I saw one guy that night I went to, initially my wife, one Essex guy. There was a guy, I think, came from Birmingham or somewhere, and he was dressed as Einstein. So he'd come all the way on the train dressed as Einstein, had everything, like the mustache, the hair.
Yeah.
And he was like in the back, like tuning his guitar up. And he was just like ready to go on. And he came out and he just stuck his tongue out off. And then he was just like, I can't be asked for this. I come all the way for this show and I've not been given like 10 seconds.
Yeah, yeah.
So, it's brutal. But I don't know. It's just, and you have to tell different kind of jokes for the gong, right?
Yes.
Like saying, you kind of a long-winded joke. Like I've seen people do one joke, which absolutely slays for like 3 or 4 minutes. You just can't really do that in a gong show because people just be like, where is this going? And then if you're off, and it's just like, you didn't tell a joke.
Yeah.
You just ranted about something that no one knew anything about, and then essentially you're gone. So I think you have to kind of win people over quickly. But I don't know. I mean, as I say, I'm just starting. So that was just my limited experience from doing one. But I'd do it again as well as I'd do the roast again.
Yeah.
Go on.
I was going to say, the one thing I will I'm not sure if I've said this on this podcast already at some point, but I do think if you're the sort of person that's going to do a gong show and you're not entirely sure how it's going to go, have another gig booked in for the within the next 2 days,
yeah,
on a normal open mic night. that you know is going to be fine. So if something does go wrong, you have less time to ponder over it.
Yeah.
I think that's one thing that a lot of people can do. I did it, is that you come off that stage and you're going over your head. What didn't work? Why didn't it? I don't understand. Usually that bit works, and that the night made no sense. And then you go back and you stew on it for 2 or 3 days.
Please.
So now you've done a few gigs on the open mic circuit. Is there anything you'd like to see change on the open mic circuit? If you could have one wish to change, what would it be?
Transport. Yeah. Like getting... It's like London, like transportation's horrible.
Oh, come on. That's a typical Londoner thing. London transport is horrible.
Well, one thing what I noticed about London is, like, when I first moved here, like from the north, and everyone has so much more time for each other up there. I'll answer the question in a minute. And then when I came down to London, it's just like everyone barges in front of everyone and everything. And I thought, it's telling people, don't ask people like how they are and whatnot. And now I've been here long enough, I'm turning into that arsehole as well.
Yeah.
Like if some pensioner just won't get on it, you just want to push them kind of into the track and get from A to Z. No, but in terms of like the comedy, the stand-up scene, what I would change is I think the bringers thing is, I mean, it's essential, right? Especially when you're starting out, you need these bringer events. And I understand the fact that these clubs, I mean, they need to stay open.
Yeah.
Right? And I mean, like myself, I'm not nowhere near as funny as a lot of these people that have been doing it for ages. Hopefully one day I might be. So we need these bringer events, but sometimes it's hard because you have to ask people. And then a lot of my friends that would come along, I feel bad about asking them to come along and see the same jokes that they've seen quite a lot, and then they'll kind of have to stay.
Yeah.
And then it gets into inviting people you don't know too well. And then it costs, doesn't it? If you invite someone, you give them a few drinks, you kind of get there, and then at the end you pay a little bit to support the night, which is fair enough, because if it wasn't for these events, it'd be hard for us to get anywhere, right? So, I mean, the bringers thing can be kind of frustrating, but I understand why it's there. And I think in terms of the structure of comedy, it's quite good because you can learn kind of your craft essentially at these places.
Oh, yes.
And you can learn like jokes and make them better and evolve them. And then eventually you'll get onto to spots where you don't have to have bringers and you get 5 or 10 minutes. And then you go to these gong nights and roast nights and then kind of network. And then if you win a gong night, you can do competition. And then there's ways to kind of progress.
Yeah.
But I think starting out, the one thing is hard is just getting people to kind of keep coming and kind of pursue something that you kind of really want to do. Because essentially they're not into it as much as you are. And you're not going to be as good as you will be in 2 or 3 years. But you still need that kind of practice.
Yeah.
So I understand why these events are there, and they kind of make sense. And it's good they are there. I'd rather them be there than not, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But it can work out a little bit kind of expensive, like starting out and getting people there, like logistically and whatnot. So that's the only thing.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think the bringers thing comes up quite a bit. It's the one thing that comedians hate. But then I think it's also the one thing that a lot of comedians understand, because, I mean, I think the bringers thing really only exists within London, because there's such a vast number of clubs that are out there, or nights that people try to fill. Whereas if you travel further outside of London, the bringer market it's not there, because there's not so many comedians fighting for so many places as such.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's you go to a lot of towns and there might be one gig a week or something like that. Whereas in London, you've got untold per night, and they all need to be filled. So yeah, the bringer is it's the evil part, but it's the understanding part. I don't think any comedian actually really wants to be there performing in front of another load of comedians.
Yeah. And there's people that kind of randomly come in as well, right?
Yeah.
Some of those nights I found, like, even if you pay for a show, like, whatever, I don't know, but some of the nights have been like the funniest I've ever seen, because it's people that are trying stuff, and like you don't know who's going to be on the bill. It's the same with like when we was doing that course and whatnot, and you'll get some people that come in and they'll just say something absolutely horrific, and then there'll be somebody else who's kind of a little bit, they do more one-liners, and then there'll be some people that I don't know, they talk about, I don't know, Dean Trance, for example, but then you'll get some other guy coming from, I don't know, some northern town or whatever, just going completely off the rails with what they're saying. And just seeing the reactions of some people is hilarious. So you can get one comic that's essentially like Bernard Manning.
Yeah.
And then you'll get kind of a Michael McIntyre.
Yeah.
In the same kind of on the same kind of night. And it's just seeing the reactions of the two kind of like polar opposite sides of comedy is absolutely hilarious.
Yeah.
And seeing some people walk out and not know what it is. I know there's one night where it's downstairs, but then the toilets are kind of next to the gig. So when people come from the pub, they have to go down and they have to go to the toilet. And it's absolutely hilarious because they're not expecting any kind of comedy. And then they just want to use the toilet and they want to be with their mates. And they'll come down and there'll be some person going on about chemo or something, like, what is going on here? And then they'll quickly scuttle back upstairs and whatnot. So some of these like nights where people are starting out and that what we're doing can be hilarious.
But that I think the place you're talking about is the Royal George in Soho. I was actually there last Thursday, and every time you sit down there and there's like the crowd leave this little pathway for those that wanted to go to the ladies' toilets. They just come down the stairs and they walk into this room. And on Thursday it was packed. There must have been 50 people in that room. And you've got all kinds going on, haven't you? And then all of a sudden you just see these random ladies walking down the stairs, and then you're thinking, oh, they're going to go to the toilet. And they just walk through the audience, and you can see their faces are like, what have I just walked into? Should I have paid for something or what? You know, but it's that night's quite good in a way, because the MC makes it clear, you know, don't be a dickhead to the people that just want to go to the toilet.
Exactly.
They're not here for that. Just ignore them, and you know, unless they shout something at you, then give them hell. But
somebody getting dressed up to go out with their friends and enjoy the night, and then there's some comedian or someone trying to be a comedian, like fat shaming someone going to the toilet, and just ruining the night. It's just like horrific. It's just like, no, they're there to go to the toilet and like have a good night. You just can't be ripping on what they're wearing, or like, you know, how many haircuts do you have, kind of thing. It's just like, yeah, just let them be and enjoy the night.
So being on stage then, what's the I do love this joke, and I embellish it as much as you can, or love this question, should I say. What is your favorite or your best joke? How did you come up with it, and how has it evolved or changed over time?
The best joke, you know, it depends who you ask. Like, some people that have seen me will argue the fact I haven't told a joke. But in terms of the best joke, it was just my mum actually came from Scunthorpe to see me, and she's always had a great personality. I come from a single parent family. Mm-hmm. Mum's always like enjoyed the same kind of dark humor as I have. I always thought I was quite funny. So she was coming, and then I had a joke about her coming, and then at Christmas she got me a gift when I was younger, and it was an art set. And it was from Rolf Harris, which essentially, I don't know anyone listening to this if they're art buffs, but Rolf Harris was an artist before he came into something else, or maybe he was always at something else. So anyway, it was just a way of going into that, and then I'd talk about the Mount Rushmore of nonces. So it was a way of doing it. But with that joke, how it evolved is just like, my mum's coming, I'm like, I'll roast her a little bit. So I was just like, my mum's come all the way from Scunthorpe. Can you please give her a hand, as she's just come out?
Yeah.
She now identifies as a parent, which is hard for me, because for the last 30 years she wasn't one. So it was essentially that joke, and then she got me kind of a gift, which was a Rolf Harris thing. But then over time, I started adding a little bit more in about like my dad as well. Like, I only met my dad twice, which was one more time than she ever met him. And then I'd have little bits in, like there was one, I've not seen my dad. Apparently, from what I've heard, he's got into banking, mainly food banks. I hope he got that milk he left for 35 years ago. So essentially, you have like the skeleton structure of a joke, right? You want to get from A to B. I want to go from my mum buying me a gift, which was innocent at the time.
Yeah.
And then the gift essentially was a Rolf Harris kind of art set. which was true.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a funny bit, not after what he was doing, but essentially that was kind of okay. And then in between that, I thought, okay, I'll roast my mum. And I started writing more kind of roasty jokes. And I mean, she really liked it. So it's good seeing like a joke kind of evolve, so to speak. Then you add bits on, you take bits out.
Yeah.
And then there's other jokes that I've had that I've liked that I just, don't do anymore. But it's just, feeling comfortable like with the writing, because the first few jokes I was writing were just, like looking back, they were just, kind of offensive, and they weren't that kind of funny. It was just, I was trying to be dark for the sake of being dark.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But then your writing kind of changes, and you realize, okay, this could be funny because of this reason. And I think with the jokes, like especially if you're doing dark ones, they can be some of the hardest to do, because you don't want to come across as an asshole, essentially.
Yeah.
You don't want to be like that person who's banging on about race or whatnot. You kind of have to come from like a vulnerable kind of position.
Yeah.
So when I've done jokes about being bald, like it's always coming from a position of I'm so insecure that I'm bald.
Yeah.
Then I would trivialize something as much as chemo. And it's not about chemo ever being funny. It isn't. It's from the position of a guy that's so insecure of himself because he doesn't have hair.
Yeah.
He trivializes something so serious because of his own like narcissism or kind of insecurity.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's my favorite joke, like roasting kind of my mother. I kind of like that one. And I liked her reaction. It was pretty good for her to come and see me do it.
Yeah.
But then it's one of those jokes I can't always use.
No.
Because if my mother isn't there, I mean, it's pointless. It's just some gingerhead guy, looks depressed, bald, banging on about a single mother or whatnot.
Yeah.
But a lot of the jokes, like with that, my mum's absolutely fantastic. So a lot of that's kind of made up, but the thing about the outset kind of wasn't. But the thing with like the jokes as well, as soon as you get one joke and it's working, it kind of can become irrelevant, right?
Yeah.
It's like if I'm banging about Rolf Harris now, someone's like, he's doing this like last year. So you kind of have to keep moving forward and stuff. So natural progression. Love Rolf Harris. Moved on to Epstein.
Yeah. No, I know what you mean. It's I've got a joke that I really actually quite liked in my original set I ever did that just nobody would get now. And you kind of get to the point, you kind of go, can I find another MP that I can use to take the piss out of in this instance that may be a bit more relevant? But then what you'll end up doing is you end up chasing your tail every few months, finding another one to try and shoehorn that name in a scenario that fits in with what the original one was.
Yeah.
Because I remember I tried the joke originally. This was, you got to bear in mind, this was after Matt Hancock was in the jungle and he was releasing a book. And I made a comment that a bloke, men's brains are so stupid. I mean, just take a look at Matt Hancock. He handed his whole WhatsApp messages to a journalist for a book and didn't expect them to get leaked. And now that was so long ago. It's just like nobody remembers who Matt Hancock is these days. Just where can you take that? So that hasn't been said for about 9 months now. And I was like, I don't quite like that joke.
Yeah, and as soon as it starts to get good, and then it's kind of like, you go back to the drawing board, essentially.
Hmm.
But lucky for us, there's always going to be famous nonces and
there's always an MP.
Politicians, so they're always going to kind of, So it's going to be that. Not lucky is probably the wrong word, right? Because they're not good people. But they're always going to be people doing silly things that you can always kind of joke about. And I always think it's funny as well, as soon as something comes out, and you'll see it in the news, and you'll be like, all right, people are going to jump all over this.
Yeah.
And then you'll get a comedy gigs like the next, I don't know, few weeks, and then a lot of people are trying these jokes and firing them out. Like, I think King Charles, a lot of people have started bringing up him. Mm-hmm. But it just seems as though, like, Prince Andrew is the one that just doesn't go away. It's like he's always doing so. I mean, he's like the one that's consistently silly, right?
Yeah. But no, I think joke evolution is once you get into this and you start. I mean, I rarely sit down and write jokes. They'll just random lines or words or things I'll see on Twitter or telly or hear in a conversation. there'll be a trigger point that I start thinking, okay, can I make something out of that?
Yeah.
And then that's the idea, and then the writing bit happens. I rarely sit down and go, I'm going to write a joke today. It's just one of those things that just kind of comes out of the blue. So I remember a time sitting with the wife on the train, and there's like a little table of four family, and it was like the kind of posh, you know, the children are called Hermione and something else ridiculous. And sorry if anybody's called Hermione and thinks it's ridiculous, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I shouldn't have
the type
named,
of name that is more flamboyant than your traditional names. And they were being little assholes on the train.
Yeah.
And it was like the wife said, you should write a little routine about how the most problematic kids you've got out there aren't the ones on council estates that are setting fires to things. It's these little bastards on trains.
Yeah.
With the posh parents just like drinking their Marks and Spencer's Prosecco waiting to get into King's Cross or something. It's like...
Exactly. And since I've known you, since we've been mates for like over the last year, I've always noticed that you hate kids. Just all kids. Just hate them.
Oh yeah, mine have grown up. Yeah. I don't need to deal with anymore. I want peace and quiet.
But I'm the same. It's like you've got an iPhone, right? You'll see something and it's and then you'll write it down and it'll just might be an idea. I remember I watched Ricky Gervais interviewed Larry David, and he was the same. He was just like, he just walks around or doing whatever, living his life.
Yeah.
And he has like a small notebook on him, and then he'll see an idea and then he'll write it down. And then when he's writing Curb, he'll have like four or five ideas. He'll be like, okay, this can maybe go with this, and this can go with this. And then he'll kind of piece together kind of an episode that way. So it's interesting to see like how people write. And I've heard of comedians that will force themselves to sit down with like nothing on around them.
Yeah.
And then they'll force themselves to write. I just find it hard. I'm like similar to you. You'll see something or you'll observe something and you're like, that's actually quite funny.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll write it down. But I don't know. It must have been harder for comedians, right? Like back in the day, because news wasn't that. It wasn't news like as easy to access as what we do now, like on our phones and stuff. I suppose there was CFAX.
Yeah, teletext.
That might have been one. Teletext. But yeah, essentially it's the same, right?
But then I guess everybody would have watched the same TV channels or read the same newspapers. So the focus would have been on a particular topic, whereas at the moment it's so spread out. You know, you would never have made a joke about the American president back in the 70s, probably, because nobody in the UK would have known who he was.
Yeah.
But now the news is so everywhere that there's got to be some people in the audience that are, you know, that are going to pick up on something. And it's that thing where you get that little bit of laughter from somebody, which then releases the call for the next person next to them to start enjoying it and laughing along, even if they don't quite get it all. They understand there's a premise in there that's quite funny.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like an easier time. Even booking gigs, for example, just going off topic slightly, just like do it through your iPhone and that lot, right? And then you can see what people are like through like Instagram and networking that way. I don't know how you do it back in the day. You just walk up to somewhere and just be like, hey, I've told like loads of jokes before, because you wouldn't essentially know, would you?
No.
Like when you apply for stuff now, like people listening kind of won't know, you kind of have to send a video in. Mm-hmm. And then they'll look at that video, they'll be like, okay, I get an idea for what this guy's kind of about and what kind of jokes he tells. You couldn't do that like a long time ago, right?
I think with them, though, it's back in the day for those open mics, they were the ones that you turn up to a pub, they'd have a bucket, you put your name in like karaoke, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Drawn out, you go tell a few jokes that you thought were funny, and that was it.
Yeah.
You'd seen Jim Davidson on the telly and thought, he's funny, I'm going to do him. And times have changed.
Yeah. But essentially, you sometimes get that. I remember we was at Richard Parr's event, right? And then we went in and there was a few people that were drunk in there. You know, when people have a bit to drink, it's like, it's like karaoke, I can do that.
Yeah.
And then they were saying to him on the break, I've got loads of trans stuff. And instantly he was like, no, you can see exactly where this is going.
Yeah.
And then the guy was like, you can't just go up and just say like vile stuff. It's kind of not how it works. It's difficult. But I mean, lucky to be in London, like this scene's pretty good in getting to places. Like we talked about and brushed on earlier, like outside of here, like if I went back up to Scunthorpe, it'd be hard getting anywhere. I've seen people on like Facebook, they travel like 2.5 hours to come into London.
Yeah, yeah.
To get on like 5 minute slots and stuff like that. So yeah, I don't know how it'd be kind of outside, but yeah, gone off a little bit there.
No, this is what this is all about, just chatting and chewing the fat about comedy and stuff, and hopefully some people that are listening to this are going to pick up some tips and hints from our experiences and maybe not make some of the same mistakes as us. You know, I was one of these that when you see a form, you filled in the form to apply to go into a night, and I thought, oh, that means I'm on the night.
Yeah, no.
And then you don't hear anything, you email say, so what happens on this night? Oh, no, you're not accepted. Oh, okay. I need to understand this situation.
Oh, and you get no feedback either.
No.
It's just like you'll apply somewhere and then you'll know someone that's got on and then you kind of haven't. It's like, what was it the jokes? Was it like what I was doing? Because you get no feedback.
Yeah.
Or you'll just be like, no, thank you. And then, or you'll get like nothing at all. But normally it's pretty good to get onto stuff. But I always find it harder to get like longer than 5 or 10 minutes anywhere.
Oh, yeah. You'll never get, I don't think in London, the stages we're at, you'd get any more than a 7 at the moment.
Yeah.
Getting tens is, if you want tens, I think that's where you have to be prepared to travel outside of London and do that rather than, stick within London because the competition is so fierce as such. But there are some nights out there that some people may have heard by the time this goes out that they try to give a couple of like 10 spots out for people that are progressing well. And there's also some that like to do split MC jobs as well, which is quite a nice idea, I think. And that's something that a lot of comedians would take up if they get the chance to.
Yeah.
You know, even if it's not doing it for the whole night, just do like for the first half or something, just be the MC for that half. And the MC role kind of will give that comedian the chance to mess about with, you know, 1 minute, 1.5 minute jokes that they've got.
Yeah.
Learn how to play off a crowd. And then if at the end of the day, if it's going badly, just introduce the next act.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to be sat there, stood there for 5 minutes dying on your ass.
But the MC is like, it's like one of the, one of the harder jobs. And it's important as well, especially with like new comedians, because if the MC doesn't care.
Yeah.
Like I've been at some places and MC's just like, too hungover or something like that. It's just like, this is Jake. James? Jake? Whatever his name is, he's up next.
Yeah.
And then it's just like, you'll go up and the crowd is just like, not into it at all. But, have you done your first MCing? Yeah, because I know he's booked in, right?
By the time this comes out, I will have, but I haven't done it as yet, no. I'm really quite looking forward to it. I was very apprehensive about taking it on. A friend that runs a local night to me just asked me, have I ever done it? No. Would you like to do it? Maybe. I kind of said to him, give me a couple of days to think about it. But then I thought about it after a day, and I was like, well, it'll give me the chance to, it'll give me a chance to flesh out the notes on the phone, because there's stuff in there that can lead to jokes, but they may not lead to, may not be sensible enough to put into a routine at the moment, but it'll be the first time I can say them and get that kind of stuff out there and off my head and not have that thing where, oh shit, how can I build this into this whole set and still keep everything making sense? So, I just said yes, sod it. I'll do it. I'll do it for the whole night as well. I'm happy to give it a go. If at the end of the day, so long as the comedians smash it out of the park, it doesn't really matter what I do.
Yeah.
If my jokes go badly, but as long as I can get people clapping before the comedians come on, and everyone has a good time, and the comedians are remembered, then job done.
But then it could go the opposite way as well, right? Like the comedians could make it easy for you, but then they could make it really bad. If they go up and then they just start like just bombing everywhere, there's some horrific jokes going down, then you kind of have to bring the crowd back, right?
Yeah, there will be a bit of that. I've been doing some interesting reading up on MC methods and stuff like that, and how if somebody's not been great, how you try to build up to the next act and get the audience back to having a bit more energy. But then also, one thing I never considered was how, if somebody smashes it out of the park, how to bring the crowd back down a level. Because you don't want the crowd up way up high, 100, and you bring on somebody that's done a very few gigs, and you know they're not going to struggle, but they're not going to hit that high point. You don't want the crowd to then suddenly just drop like a stone.
Yeah.
So you need to kind of bring them down from 100 down to like 60, and then let the person take over from that point to then bring it back up to like a 70 or 80, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. And sounding a little bit of a dick, sometimes I like it when the person before me kind of bombs. Because if they kill, right, and it's just like, you're going to follow that. If somebody's just like hit after hit after hit after hit. And then obviously, like you said, the crowd are up and then they're expecting that from me. And I just come up and it's just kind of not there. So sometimes, you know, it's we've all been in that position where we bomb, right?
Oh, yeah.
But sometimes I'd
you
rather
were there
somebody
when
bomb
I
before me. I don't think I've ever seen bomb like bomb. Like, I've seen some real bad bombs. I've seen people like just walk off after a minute and just like not tonight. Like speaking about Larry David again, there was that when he was talking about doing stand up like first when he was first doing it, he just came out and looked at the crowd and he was just like, they're not gonna get this. So he just stared at them and he was just like, nah. And he just left. Didn't even say a joke. He was just like, nah, I could just tell looking at them, none of this is going to go down very well at all.
Yeah.
So, as much as you don't want anyone to bomb, I'd rather somebody bomb than destroy before me. Unless it's someone that I get on with like yourself, you wouldn't want that to happen. But.
Okay, so, all right. We'll lead on to a positive point then now. So you've smashed it for the last few years. You're about to do your... live at the Apollo special, you get your 20 minutes.
Which will probably come out by the time this comes out, right? So it's just in like 5 weeks. I think I'll have done, people have already known what I'm coming out to by the time.
Please. I got you before you got really famous.
So yeah, my own head.
You're about to walk out in front of 5,000 people at Hammersmith Apollo.
Yeah.
You've got your set ready. You know it by heart. You've seen the crowd. What do you choose as your walk-on music?
It's got to be Ric Flair. It's got to be something to do with wrestling. It's got to be Ric Flair. You know, come out in like a robe or something like that. You know, the Ric Flair. Dun, dun. I'll have to send it to you. People know Ric Flair.
Yeah, I think people know Ric Flair is, music. But the music.
Yeah, the music essentially, I think I wrote, is it Sparta? It's like classical music.
Okay.
You'll have heard it before, but it's a little bit kind of gets people going a little bit more than something like Time to Say Goodbye. It has to be a little bit uplifting, right?
Yeah.
But it has to also, just as long as you get people. Or it could be like The Ultimate Warrior. Do you know him?
Yes, I remember like The Ultimate Warrior.
Yeah, so he'd come out and he was like, duh, 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 duh. So he'd just run essentially to the ring. He was just roided up out of his head.
Yep.
So his wrestling matches never went beyond like 45 seconds. And then he'd just come in, he'd lift someone up, he'd be huffing and puffing, pin them, and then he'd run straight back out. So I suppose you could do that with comedy as well, right? Like have something like the Ultimate Warrior kind of music on. You sprint out onto the stage. You just do one joke. That's it. 45 seconds. And then just sprint right back off. I don't know if they'd have you back at the Apollo. People have bought tickets. It's just like, I was Jake Ward. It was all right for as long as it lasted. I think it was like a minute long. But it'd have to be some kind of wrestling kind of music. Or something like uplifting.
Yeah.
It can't be something too drab. Or, I don't know how you'd associate it with like your act as well, because it kind of has to be. I mean, if it acts dark, I don't know. Yeah, Ric Flair. People who listen to this will know like who Ric Flair and his entrance music is. I'll send it to you after this. It's fantastic, and the way he comes to the stage as well is absolutely fantastic. He's always in like a robe that's kind of lit up.
Yeah,
takes it slow. You know, talks to the crowd and whatnot. And so it'd have to be that. I think.
I'm trying to imagine you. I'm trying to imagine the Jake version of that.
Of
walking on with a dressing gown,
yeah,
and like a shower cap for irony more than anything else.
Yeah, it would be a shower cap. It'd be a hat. I mean, it'd have to be like a prop, like carrot top. But if you're going to go the wrestling route, I would have to wear like spandex and no shirt. So, if I knew I was going to be on at the Apollo, I'd need like at least 6 weeks' notice to try and get in some kind of shape.
Yeah.
But I don't know many comedians. I mean, there's Bert Kreischer that just go up and do shirtless at the Apollo. I think it's more likely to be a man than a woman, but no, let's not go down that route kind of thing. But yeah, it'd be some kind of wrestling just to get everybody kind of up. But then your jokes would have to be good, wouldn't they?
They would.
Because if you get everybody up, like cheering and whatnot, and then you get up and then...
My mother-in-law.
My mother-in-law, she's terrible. Terrible. Why did that chicken cross that road? Knock, knock.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff, it'd go down terribly.
Okay. So Ric Flair, the low budget version of Ric Flair, that'd be quite funny.
Low budget version of Ric Flair as well. You can see, like, there's a really good documentary. Is it kind of a documentary about Ric Flair? It's like on 50/50, and it's about how he was like, he's been married like 8 or 9 times, about his womanizing ways. And, and he'd come out with this like white silver mullet, an amazing kind of aviator shades. And talk absolute drivel for like 15 minutes. But it was all fantastic stuff. Going on about like snakeskin shoes and whatnot, and people were lapping it up. So if he was going to do something like that, a lot of people would associate it with him rather than some bald, unhappy, wannabe comic from Scunthorpe. So I might have to give it kind of a second thought. Something like that would be great. But like I said, uplifting. It kind of has to be. But do people come out to music at the Apollo?
They must do. There must be something. Yeah. I've seen a few, but it might be even just. I think the reason the question kind of came to my head for this podcast was that I quite like Paul Smith.
Yeah,
and he walks out to AC/DC.
Okay,
and that kind of just like that big punch and the and it just made me wonder. It's like if you could pick what it was going to be, what would you choose? And that's just a.
I mean, that's a good one. From. Is that? I imagine is it Thunderstruck?
I think it's Back in Black. I think it is the one he comes out to.
Well, I mean, that suits his act as well, right?
Yeah.
Because he goes into the crowd and it gets there. I mean, something like that's a perfect choice. Something like that hits hard. I couldn't imagine someone coming out to Enya. Like Enya, like Sail Away or whatnot. Someone kind of drifts out and then they start telling X, Y, and Z. But I suppose it could be a juxtaposition if you come out and start doing really dark stuff and you come up with something as beautiful as Enya.
Yeah, the other reason that kind of came into my head as well was because I don't know if you ever listened to the Have a Word podcast with Adam Rowe and Dan Nightingale. And it's probably the biggest comedy podcast in the UK. But what they did at one point was they both went on tour at similar times, but they got to pick each other's walk-on music.
Okay,
and I think there was a thing where they were discussing that you can't be too harsh. The person that goes first can't be too harsh, because otherwise it's going to come back tenfold. And I can't remember what Dan chose for Adam Rowe, but what Adam Rowe chose for Dan Nightingale was the British national anthem. And Dan's first show, I think, was in Belfast.
Okay. Oh, that's great. So they didn't know, like, previous to, like, walking on what it was going to be.
Oh, they knew it was going to be when they were walking on. But the audience didn't know. So you can imagine, I think Dan Nightingale's got a video clip of him going up to the sound desk before, you know, when he's got there to do a sound check. He says, can you play this for me when I walk on stage? And they're like, we're not going to play that. He says, no, you've got to play it. It's like, you really don't want us to play that now. Like, no, I need you to play it.
Yeah, I mean, that's really good because winding people up or annoying them before you actually do your set would be like, how could you follow that kind of thing?
But it's such a good thing because he can then explain to the crowd, you know, whilst after they've all been booing for the last, whatever it is, 45 seconds, why it exists. And then it becomes the fun story of why it exists. And it leans into the set and stuff like that, so I think it's actually quite good. It's because it's not like it's people are going and bought tickets for a comedy club to see some random person. They've gone to see a particular person.
Yeah.
So you know you're going to be liked anyway, but yeah, having that little thing I think is quite cool.
Yeah. All right.
So then, we're both on the open mic comedy circuit. So what if you somebody was to come to you and say, you know, I'm thinking about doing it, or I've just started doing it, what's just one tip you'd give that person?
Therapy's easier. Do therapy, it's better. Like most, like comedians or whatever, I hate using that because we only just started, right?
Yeah.
So it's just someone that's got an interest in comedy and try to do it. So, but try therapy. Maybe, you know, speak to your parents. Like, try, maybe because a lot of like comedians and what you see, right? A lot of, it can be quite like dark and yeah. Things have happened. Like, why would you like seek the approval of people you don't know?
Yeah.
It's just mad. It's just like you'll go up there and you'll try to make random people laugh and then you'll get hurt kind of if they don't. Yeah. I mean, the whole premise of stand-up comedy is essentially a little bit mad, right?
Yeah.
Just standing there for 5 minutes just telling jokes and hoping somebody will laugh.
Yeah.
And you'll probably never see them again kind of thing. But in seriousness, a bit of advice would be get there's other ways to get help and there's other ways to kind of deal with life. But no, course is look into a course if you think you're funny, or if you think you've got some good ideas and you want to do them.
Mm.
Either do a course essentially if you can't either afford it or you don't have the time. Do like a bring a night. There's plenty of places that are quite funny around London, like the ones in Stockwell. GMB is really good.
Yeah.
And like usually the MCs know kind of what's going on. They say at the start, this is for either people trying new material or people that are doing it for the first time. Take a few people that you know with you so you've got a little bit of support. And do it that way. I mean, you know, like courses and stuff like that. I mean, the best advice, like, I think we've been given is just like, just do as many gigs as you can.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, ride the waves. Like you said, you had a tough time early in the year and now you've got back. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then you can feel demoralized and then you like want to stop or you like have a week off and you're like, I can't believe that went like it did, or you'll get horrific feedback, but then it'll kind of go up. But for your first time, take people around you and go to like a new comic friendly.
Yeah.
No, actually, skip all that. Can you edit that out? Do a roast battle. Just for your first, do a roast battle with someone amazingly experienced. Just do that. It'll fill you with confidence. Just, yeah, like that. And then you'll definitely be in therapy.
Yeah, I think the number one tip from Jacob there is do the roast battle, but don't do it too soon.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Cool. There is if you've listened to this podcast before, you'll know what's coming up. We're going to finish on what I like to call the Comedian's Challenge, which I have a book here, which is called The Little Book of Shit Jokes by Sid Finch. And I'm asking every comedian to pick a joke from this book to put into their set, record it, post it, tag us, etc., etc. The only thing is that you get to pick your joke, but you don't get to pick it by the joke itself. You get to pick it by page number.
Okay.
And if you pick a page that somebody else has already chosen, then tough luck, you have to pick again. So are you up for that?
Yeah, the only thing I'm worried about with doing this is it might end up being better than anything I've read.
It could well be. Who knows?
It's been like my closer. It was like, oh, the only joke you had that was any funny, like, oh, funny, Jacob, was you like your last joke? Where'd you get the book of shit jokes? And that was it. A year doing it, and then, but anyway.
So you can pick between numbers between 5 and 95.
77.
What was that?
77.
Okay, you've got two jokes on this page. You can either have joke one or joke two.
Joke two.
Okay. The joke I want you to tell to an audience and have it filmed is, a book just fell on my head. I only have my shelf to blame.
Okay. I mean, everyone likes literature, so it'll be relatable to everyone. A book just fell on my head. What was it? A book just fell on my head.
I only have my shelf to blame. It's actually interesting to see how these I've seen a few of these now, how people have incorporated them into their set. If you want any ideas, I would strongly recommend having a look at Chris Alley's joke. It was very well done. He incorporated it quite well into his set, and then he tagged on to the end of it, which was quite nice as well. So it didn't sit in isolation. It actually formed part of a little 20-30 second bit. And I thought that was pretty cool.
I mean, you're going to have to incorporate this with something. Oh, I just might, like I say, just get my wife on the iPhone to play that Ultimate Warrior music, fire onto the stage, just do that joke and then fire off. Or alternately, do it like a gong show. Have that as like your first joke at the gong show and see if you can last more than like 10 seconds. See you that way. But no, it's clever that Chris Alley, like I saw you've actually put that up, you've shared it.
Yeah.
If you could tag it on with something. But usually if you do like a very dark joke, I've always found, and then you afterwards go straight into like an Ant and Dec joke, for example, or something really like hearted. And then, that kind of up and down thing. But no, it's good. No,
he's already thinking how to use it.
100%, 100%, I'm going to do it.
100%.
Don't know if it'll be a gong show though.
I'm not. I wouldn't advise using it at a gong show. Don't waste that chance.
imagine though, when this comes out, if I actually was on at the Apollo, I did this joke in a slot,
dressed as Rick Flair. Viral.
Half a million, followers on Instagram and stuff. But yeah.
So, what is your that brings us nicely actually to the kind of the closing part. So, what how can people find you on Instagram, etc.? What's your handle and what do you put on there?
It's at Ginger Jacob. So it was Ginger Jacob, but I got hacked like 2 weeks ago, and I think it took me like 4 or 5 years to get up to 600 followers.
Yeah.
Or something like that, and then you just go back to square one. And it's hard as well because I don't know if people like when they book you or whatnot, they'll like look at your Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, no one likes this guy. It's like the only people following is like his mother and his dog. So I don't know if he's going to be any good or not. But yeah, at Ginger Jacob. So GINJAJACOB. So if you see what I did there with the spelling.
Yeah, very clever.
I was like 14 when I did that. I used to play online games, and then that was like kind of my tag. But I remember you saying about my email address. Obviously, I won't say it now. It was like, what kind of email address is that? And it was the first part of my university email address, which was 2007 now, I think it was.
Wow. Cool. So I'll get that put into the link in the description of this podcast anyway, so people can find you, and hopefully we can grow you from your mother and dog to something more respectable and back to where it was in the past.
I think that podcast coupled with this joke, I think we'll definitely do it.
I think it might do three or four.
Yeah.
We shall see. So what are your future plans really for the rest of the year in comedy?
Well, I mean, London's expensive, right? So I'm not originally from it, so I'm going to try and do as much as possible. So ideally gigs as I can, and then hopefully get onto these like competitions, because when you apply to get longer sets, they'll ask you like, what have you done in comedy? And then if you beat a few of these gong nights, roast battles, do a little bit of like headlining some of these bring-up events, then you'll get more opportunities. Go to Edinburgh. I've got a friend out there, fortunately, I could stay with. Because, like you were saying, it's, what is it, £400 a night or something?
It's
something
crazy
ridiculous.
Money.
Just to experience that whole event and hopefully get a few spots, 5-10 minutes here and there.
So,
I'm waffling a little bit. Yeah, just do more gigs, hopefully win a couple of competitions, beat a couple of gong nights, and then get the opportunity to do longer sets and shows.
Cool. Well, okay then. I'll just say thank you for your time today. It's been a lot of fun catching up.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thanks for having me on and that lot. And it's been a fantastic journey. And long may it continue for both of us. It's good to have somebody that I started with that's still doing it.
Yeah.
And we do like similar gigs in similar places. And it's good we can like ride the waves together.
Yes.
So once it goes bad for a few months, we like talk to each other and whatnot, and then hopefully get back on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, thank you. I appreciate this.
No problem. And on Instagram, you can find us at Open Mic Comedy Pod. We are on the W's at openmiccomedypod.com. Whichever platform you're listening to us on, please give us a follow, subscribe, whatever it is these days. A little review would be nice. If it's a 5-star, they're always welcome. And just share it with people that you think might be interested in it. So until next time, I'll see you all soon.